welcome to Curmudgeon's Corner for Sunday, April 3rd, 2011. I'm Sam Minter. And that is Yvonne Bo trumpeting in.
We could have that, you know, next time for our intro. I don't know, since we haven't changed it, you know, what's that Battlestar Galactica March song thing? There we go. You know, I was watching something on TV today, and that's how they introed it. I thought it was kind of funny.
I was thinking more like the Darth Vader theme from Star Wars.
Well, we could have that one too, but you know.
Yeah, you know.
We could alternate. There you go.
Yeah, I don't know. If anybody has any suggestions for changes, like, you know, I'll let us know.
We've done 300 shows with, you know, this is 200.
Plus the old show, yeah.
Yeah, for a song I picked from an album by a New Age artist, Ray Lynch, like a long time ago. So the song has got to be like 30 years old. So anyway.
And we're hoping, we use a very small... We use like 10 seconds at the beginning and another like 10 seconds at the end. And so we're hoping we can, you know, get away with that without like paying royalties and stuff. But, you know.
Yeah, I haven't heard anything from Ray Lynch.
And so, we're not like a huge hit with like millions of people listening. So maybe we're under the radar. But I did notice at one point that Ray Lynch has on his website, like you can click through and, you know, purchase rights to use these songs. I have no idea what the rates are, but... You know. Anyway.
Okay.
But we have not yet done that.
Apparently, I just saw that he has sold over 2 million albums, surprisingly.
So, I was always figuring if we ever get so we're averaging more than 100 listeners a week, then we should, like, figure out that shit and, like, go legit.
I guess.
But, you know.
Okay.
Anyway.
Yeah, there it is. Stop music license. Okay.
Right. So we've got a few things on the agenda today. First of all, we got a piece of feedback that we got from one of our listeners. We'll talk a little bit about updates in Libya and what's been going on there. And a little bit about some of the exciting Republican candidates who've been coming up. The Republican race is starting a little slow, but, you know, there are a few people jumping in and... with some interesting stuff going on. There's a little battle brewing between cable companies versus content providers on some ways they're looking at distributing that content specifically on tablet apps. Then finally, if we have time, Yvonne wants to say a few things about his friend Charlie Sheen.
Yes, my buddy.
Buddy, yes. So let's get started. Feedback. I am going to anonymize who this is from and leave out some of the information that might be personally identifiable. But here we go. So they mentioned that, I had mentioned on the show I had two family members on break. And so did I, in fact... get a chance to do a short overnight trip somewhere, as I'd hinted might be possible on the show. The answer is no, we have not done that. If we were going to have done that, it would have been this weekend. It would have been last night, and we ended up not doing it. So why?
Why? Chicken out.
Well, you know, look, there are a couple things. First of all, I don't know. Well, one thing is, like, we had a couple of unexpected expenses in the last couple of weeks, and we were like, do we really want to spend a little bit more money going out somewhere and getting a hotel and blah, blah, blah? But, you know, that wasn't really the primary factor, I think. It's just, like, we were...
tired.
Inertia. I don't know. It's just like,
I hear you.
It's like we had a couple of days. Amy's off at some like event related to one of her choruses in Oregon. I should say her chorus. She's not more than one. In Oregon. So we had just the three of us here. We did go see a kids movie. And Alex did pretty well at the movie. And not perfectly. So I'm going to go see the movie again because I missed some of it, and yes, it was like a stupid kids movie, but this is one of those things I'm anal about. Like, so I saw most of the movie, but like missed like 5-10 minutes near the end. And I'm like, God damn it, I have to see, you know, the whole movie. So, anyway.
I hear you about that. Okay.
The movie was Hop,
I don't know.
For anybody who, you know, cares. It's about, like, the Easter Bunny.
Yeah, but I saw the previews yesterday. You know, I was trying to see if we saw any movies to go to the movie theater to go watch, and I couldn't come up with any. So we come home, and my wife is insisting on watching again Sex and the City 2. Okay, and I'm just like, wait. I mean, first of all, I think I did not go to the theater and watch it with her. She went with somebody else. Now she's put it on TV before, and I've like been forced to watch pieces of it. And I used to be a fan of the original, the first few seasons of Sex and the City, but then it just got stupid and I just couldn't stand it anymore. But the movie is just ridiculous. So I'm like, I want to watch. I had not watched the movie Inception. Okay.
I have not seen that either. I don't know, so don't give anything away.
Okay. And I wanted to watch it. So what I wound up doing is that I fucking fired up the computer and I rented it on iTunes while she watched Sex and the City 2. Because I was just like, okay, I'm not going to watch this fucking thing. So.
Okay, so to continue, 72 minutes, this is in reaction to like a couple shows ago, 72 minutes, mm-hmm. Too long, really struggled to stay with you, but determined to finish. You know, and this is me responding again, we've gone through a few different phases on the length of the show, you know, at first they were like, 20-30 minute shows, then we got longer and longer, and I think we had one show that went over an hour and a half, and then we sort of determined we need to cut that down. Let's target doing 4 10 minute segments, which would put us in at 40 minutes plus breaks, so about 45 to 50 minutes total for the show. And then we sort of just started talking again, and we've had I'd say about half of our recent shows have been over an hour, and we have had feedback from like a couple people way back in time saying no, I like them long. I listen on my commute, and you know it's good when they're long, so you know we could go either way. And recently we've just sort of not been thinking about it too much. We try to do four major topics per show, and you know, have that, you know, be you know, however long those four topics take, you know, and then we usually have like something minor, you know, like this first segment. Often we have like the little personal blather, you know. So, but you know, yes. four major topics is sort of the thought.
But I keep forgetting also that we add the breaks.
Yeah, we do have I mean, the breaks are usually only a couple minutes long, and the poem is only a couple minutes long usually. But I mean, right now we've already been going 8 minutes in this segment, and I've gotten through the first two sentences of the feedback. You know, because we've
okay. So let's yeah, because we are just a bunch of blathering idiots. Okay, so let's get rolling on this. Okay, here we go.
Okay.
All right.
Then Yvonne went viral with variants of the F word from Japan on. Which really gets in the way of whatever points he wants to make, and to me is supremely annoying. Sometimes I just quit when he starts going that way. My ears can't stand it. But I made the end of the show.
Okay, all right. Well, so, sorry.
You know,
I'm not sure why it went that wild.
We have heard this feedback before. We've talked about it a few times. I think, you know, it's just the way language works these days, and I understand that some people are very sensitive to it, and sorry, but like for us to
I will do this. Look, I'll make an effort to minimize my use of it, okay, since I've noticed that we've had far more people listening to it, and I know that some people just don't like it, but I'll make an effort to just not go into a, as he described, just, you know,
going viral.
Okay, yeah, I'll try not to do that. Okay, there you go. Pause that.
Okay, continuing. You talked about the general principle that outsiders should prevent genocide when they see it about to happen or happening. Isn't that what World War II was about, at least in part? Hitler was committing genocide. The world stepped in to try to stop it. You know, I
not really.
Yeah, here's the thing.
I think we discovered the genocide afterwards.
I think that's mostly, well, some of it was known. But the extent was not known until we came in afterwards, right. But it was clearly known that Hitler was doing bad things to the Jews. And
the primary driver of us going into the war was not that at all. I mean, he was basically, invading the UK. He took over mass pieces of Europe, threatening,
It was self-defense. And the U.S. in particular did everything it could for an extended period of time to stay out. Now, that was a conflict there. Like, I think FDR wanted to get in and Congress didn't. And so it sort of waited until there was enough stuff piled up for him to be able to say, okay, we have no choice now. We're getting in. And of course, he was supporting the UK and others on that side of the war with arms and other things.
Munitions, arms, and other stuff
before the US actually got into the war. But I think, frankly, if Japan had never attacked the US, if at some point, let's say, Hitler successfully took over parts of Europe and then stopped without attacking the UK, without attacking Russia, and had just consolidated his hold over the center part of Europe and continued to kill all the Jews he wanted, we probably would never have gotten involved. I'm not sure that that's, a shining example of moral clarity there, but I'm not sure that we would have.
I'm not sure we would have. I mean, let's face it, there was plenty of genocides that happened before. I mean, my gosh. I mean, let's face it. Stalin had been doing purges and genocides in his country with everybody looking the other way, and nobody got in there and invaded, Russia.
Although there's certainly the argument here, and this is part of what, Obama's argument on Libya is as well, is there's a question also of feasibility. Like, you go in when you can. And there's certain...
I agree. I mean,
there was no realistic situation where we could have said, Stalin, you're killing a bunch of people. We're going to go take over Russia. Or the Soviet Union at the time. But, that just was not going to happen. And I'm sure there probably were some people that would have loved to take on that war. But, it just wasn't going to be a practical outcome. They were too big, too powerful. And, anyway, moving on. The world is very fascinating right now. So much happening in so many places. Turmoil and change. It is my belief that change is the normal state of things, but many places being quite traditional static cultures and usually autocratically ruled have gone a long time without change. So now that it is coming, the outcome is unpredictable and will likely surprise us all. In traditional cultures, the objectives of life were to reproduce in your generation what your parents and grandparents knew and had. New thought are not felt to be needed, but things slowly evolve anyway, and we are now seeing an explosion. I think education has raised aspirations and understanding that there are other options. These are very dangerous times, but exciting in their possibilities. I certainly don't disagree. There's a lot of interesting stuff going on. Let's see. Okay, this next section I'm going to do some creative editing on. War. My own instincts and desires are for never supporting war. Pacifism. Not passive, though, like several she knows. I have never touched, picked up, tried to learn to use a gun of any kind, and would not like to live in a house where there was one. However, pure pacifism can be a very selfish, self-centered position. Let's see.
Let me make a comment. I mean, I have to agree with him. I think that one of the problems that you have of people that are strictly pacifists. I mean, say you're standing right here and you see somebody go and like try to abuse somebody that's right by you. Well, I'm a pacifist. I'm not going to stop it. I'm like, that's just. I mean, you're just as bad as a guy that's abusing him. If you have the power to try to stop somebody from doing it,
I think this is our listener's point here, and they give a couple of examples, but basically situations where if you are in the position where people are being abused or killed or downtrodden or taken advantage of or whatever, and you are in a position where you could make a difference to them. You could help them. You could make their lives better, perhaps through the use of violence against the people who are being evil towards them, then to sit there and say, sorry, no, I can't commit violence, is perhaps, you know, selfish, because, you know, in some sort of moral calculus where you add up the pros and cons, yes, you may have to do something that is unpleasant, and that if there was not appropriate justification for, might itself be an evil act. But if you are doing it in the name of, you know, making the situation better for a lot of people, it can still be the right thing to do. And, you know, and I generally agree with that. I think you get into, and there's a lot of very interesting stuff. You can take whole classes on this in terms of moral philosophy and, you know, the philosophy of war in particular, I guess, and just war and all of these concepts that are around this. You get into some very, like, if you try to put together a consistent moral framework that handles all of these situations and gives you some sort of calculus where you add up the number of people you kill versus the number of people you save or anything like that, there are all kinds of different mechanisms to do that, and none of them are completely satisfying, because they'll treat some situations you think sort of quote-unquote the right way, but you can always find other situations where it gives you answers that you're like, really? No, that can't be right. And so you end up with something that's very situational. And, you know, maybe that's all you can do. I don't know. But anyway, but I generally agree with the concept, although I must say I am very queasy in general about the violent options. And I've gotten more so over the years, in terms of, you know, you want to be fairly sure that what you are going to do really is going to end up that having that positive effect. And of course, you can never be completely sure. And you want to be, I don't know, you want to be very careful. You want to make sure it really is the last resort. You've tried everything else. There's nothing else you can do. Because the problem with, you know, this kind of violence is it's irreversible. You know, the damage you cause is going to be permanent. And it is the kind of thing that is very, very, very easy to screw up. And the unintended consequences are always out there and tend to be massive, and so you may go in with the best of motivations and end up with a disaster anyway. And I mean, I know you always have that capability, but I've heard a few people make the argument in terms of Libya in the last week, and it started to sway me a little bit. I still think it was a bad idea, probably, and I'm still very worried about the potential outcomes, but I've heard a few people plead the case that says, look, if we hadn't gone in, Gaddafi would have massacred, you know, tens of thousands of people in these cities. He said he was going to. He outright said, we are going to go in those cities and we're going to, you know, we're going to slaughter the people who have been against us. And we had the opportunity to stop that. And we did, you know, regardless of what else is happening at this point. I mean, there's a, you know, there's a civil war that the ultimate outcome of which is still very unclear, and what we're going to do is unclear. But what we did stop his forces from going into those cities and perpetrating that kind of massacre. And
I agree.
Yeah, who knows? Maybe it was all bluster. Maybe he wasn't going to anyway. But certainly from his actions in the last few weeks, it certainly seemed credible. So yeah, and so the argument was, how could we sit back and not stop that? You know, regardless of what the long-term consequences are, we can't predict the future, but we were in a position where we could have stopped that. How could we not do it? I can see that argument, you know? And so a couple other final things, and then we'll close off this feedback and take a break. I listen very carefully to whether military action will leave the people in a better or worse situation position than before it is taken. If they will be worse off at the end, it definitely should not happen. I do not accept even that American interest is an adequate excuse if it means worse lives for local people despite better business opportunities for us foreigners. Evil exists just as much as change does. And sometimes evil refuses to compromise or be talked out of power. And it doesn't care who gets hurt and considers vengeance normal. Also, a recommendation. Actually, if you have time, I recommend a book I recently finished called The Tenth Parallel, Dispatches from the Fault Line Between Christianity and Islam by Eliza Griswold. A very fine investigative reporting job that tells unbelievable yet true and enlightening stories from Nigeria, Somalia, Sudan, Indonesia, and the Philippines, from cultures and worldviews so very different from our own experience, but out of which real people with real power operate. I had heard of that book. I actually think I'd heard of it from this person before in a posting they made somewhere. But it's on my list of potential books to read. Of course, though, there are several hundred books there, so I don't know when or if I'll get to it, but it is on my list. That's pretty much the end of the feedback. So any final thoughts there, Yvonne, or should we take our break?
Nah, I think we should take our break. I think we're good.
Okay, we're taking our break. We will come back and talk a little bit about what's next on the list. I guess we'll do a little Libya since we touched on that in the feedback. We will be back after this. Okay, we're back. So, Libya, we touched on this a little bit. You know,
Libya.
There Yvonne goes. You know, there's been a bunch of stuff going on. I mean, the actual on the battlefield sort of back and forth really has been back and forth. You know, the rebels took some more ground, then they got pushed back, then, you know, blah, blah, blah. Yeah, who knows what's going to happen there. And, you know, we turned over command to NATO, whatever that really means. Supposedly, the other air forces are also going to take more of the responsibility for patrolling the no-fly zone. I gather that we've basically finished up most of our, you know, bombing of fixed targets and things like that that we thought were necessary to enforce the no-fly zone. But I've heard other people say it just died down because of weather and will probably speed up again once weather is better. There were a couple pilots downed. Maybe this was last week, but I don't think we talked about it. They got rescued. The interesting thing there is that one of them fairly quickly got picked up by our own forces. The other one got met on the ground by friendly Libyans. Yeah, he wasn't sure they were friendly Libyans at first, who took him to a hotel where he phoned to tell his commanders where he was.
Well, there you go. Yeah. Well, there you go. That's a nice, but you know, that's nice.
We've had a number of defections continuing, the most prominent of which was the Libyan foreign minister who made a secret flight to the UK and then, you know, said he was resigning and pleading for asylum. And he's somewhat an interesting case. And it's interesting that he went to the UK as well, because he's also been implicated in the TWA bombing in the 80s. So this is not exactly a guy with no blood on his hands. You'd think he'd, like, if he was going to flee somewhere, you'd think he'd flee somewhere else, but, you know, whatever.
We didn't have that many choices.
Yeah, yeah. But anyway, so you've sort of got Gaddafi's government crumbling from the inside as well. There are rumors that keep persisting that negotiations are going on about an exit plan for Gaddafi to get him off into exile somewhere. And, you know, so all that's going on. Bob Gates, the defense secretary, continues to sort of express skepticism. And he, by the way, and people have been saying, is he going to resign, blah, 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 because he kind of obviously disagrees with the rest of the administration on this. One thing is, he's scheduled to leave office anyway. He had told the president, I believe, that he wanted to leave, you know, by the end of the year or something like that and move on to other things. But there's been speculation, would he leave earlier in a sort of visible way where he says, you know, I disagree with you, I'm resigning, which would be far more spectacular than him just sort of quietly grumbling for a few more months and then leaving. You know, and I think a lot of his concerns are just around the, you know, seriously, are we doing this? Are we really getting ourselves into this? We had reports leaked that Obama, at one of the meetings leading up to this intervention, described the whole situation as a turd sandwich, basically saying that none of the options were any good whatsoever, and he was having to pick, you know, which kind of bad option he really wanted, and he wasn't happy.
That's
about
right.
And you know, and there was,
and I believe that I read that he was quoting somebody else who had mentioned to him. That was what it was, okay? Just to be clear, it wasn't his original description. That's what I read a little bit later. So,
well, you know, and the thing is, and you know, I'll try to get the email I sent about it to get the quote. But some blogger was basically saying, "Look, why couldn't he?
Why the fuck did you just say this to everybody in the first place?"
Yeah, and I think one of the biggest problems with this whole thing so far has been Obama's handling of the communication around it. I mean, you know, first of all, the whole thing where, you know, he's taking us into military action, and he, you know, announces it through, like, you know, a couple minute sort of aside in the middle of a press conference about Brazilian trade. Okay, that's no, sorry, not good enough. Then, like a week later, then he goes on primetime TV and talks about it. But it's all very—I don't know. I only read it. I did not watch his speech live. Did you watch it?
No, I did not.
So, you know, he basically he justified things. He made it was a good speech. It sounded good when you listened to it. It all sort of was like, oh, okay, rah, you know, we had to do this, blah, blah, blah. But, you know, there are a lot of things that when you actually looked at what he said in details, sort of, you know, avoided major questions and sort of, you know, diminished the various criticisms coming in and didn't really directly address them. And so I don't know. It wasn't completely satisfying either, you know? And yeah, and if behind the scenes, he really was like, look, this is a bad situation. We don't like any of the options, but we've got to do something. Let's do something. That would have gotten, I think, a lot more respect than his sort of waiting a while and then making a little speech and emphasizing how, you know, we're not going to be leading it. And, you know, there's international support where, you know, look, yes, there's international support, but behind the scenes, we were pushing for that support. So don't say it's not us ultimately making the decision, and don't say that it's, you know, we're doing it because of a UN resolution. I mean, fundamentally, it's our decision.
But I was reading that the final pressure came really more because Sarkozy was convinced by this guy that came to Paris and presented himself, you know, brought these guys who were, you know, trying to be the leaders of the rebel group and pretty much, you know, persuaded Sarkozy that, you know, if the West didn't take any action, they were going to be fucked.
Right.
And, you know, he took the lead into trying to persuade the U.S. and everybody else. And that's one of the reasons why the first sorties that came out were from France, because they were the ones that really took the lead in trying to bring everybody on board for this, you know? So, you know, it wasn't like they were out there, like, also pounding the pavement. It came down to a point where Sarkozy came and just convince everybody, guys, are we fucking kidding me? We've got to do this.
Yeah.
You know?
And then we've got, you know, the whole thing about Congress and whether or not Congress needs to be involved here. And a couple weeks ago, we talked briefly about the fact that historically, presidents have always, of both parties, of every party, going back even before, you know, the Republicans existed and we had Whigs and stuff, you know, presidents have always argued that they have the right to initiate this kind of military action. However, Obama and Biden had both been quoted in various situations before they were in the presidency about how, you know, Congress's involvement was crucial and the president did not have the right to initiate military action other than sort of direct self-defense kind of stuff, you know, without congressional, you know, involvement and approval and stuff. And not only did Obama not do any of that, but in comments this week, apparently in closed door sessions, classified sessions with the Congress, Hillary was asked questions about this, and the reports have differed. The first reports basically said, you know, we don't care what Congress does, and if Congress does anything, we're going to ignore it anyway. Later reports said, okay, it wasn't quite that blunt. She did the usual sort of equivocation where she didn't answer the question. However, you know, the War Powers Resolution from the 70s, which, you know, presidents again argue is unconstitutional limits on their power, but requires that within 60 days, the president get authorization from the Congress to continue. Now, I think Obama hopes that within 60 days, this is all done and over with.
We're done and we're out. Yeah.
We'll see. But I think it's very troubling. I'm one of the ones who thinks that Congress really needs to step up and assert its power in this area and be like, no, Congress has the power to decide when we go to war, period. Not the president. The president, as commander-in-chief, has the ability to run the war once we've decided to get in, but it needs to be Congress's decision to get in. And I think, you know, Congress over the last 200 years, 200 plus years, has basically, you know, decided they don't really care to exercise that power. And so, of course, the presidents have taken that power. And I don't know that, you know, this Congress is going to do anything much different, although there are a few people, and it's an interesting combination. It's like, you know, the more right-wing Republicans plus the more left-wing liberals or Democrats sort of agree on this right. topic, and all the people in the middle are yep. like, we don't really want to think about this. Yeah. But, yep. But you know, I don't know that this Congress is actually going to do anything about it, but they should. And, you know, Obama should, like, you know, respect what his own views apparently were before he became president and be like, yes, this is something that, you know, Congress should have a say in. Let's go to the Congress and see what they have to say. He can even say, look, this was an urgent situation. We had to launch this action within 24 hours or, you know, tens of thousands of people would have been slaughtered. We could not wait for a congressional debate. Fine. The War Powers Act actually allows for that, and that's why this 60-day limit is there, you know, but it appears at the moment that the president's just going to not do anything with Congress, not solicit their involvement at all, and I think that's a wrong direction, but I don't know. Anything else to say about Libya? We've been more than 10 minutes.
No, I mean, I think we covered most of the stuff. I mean, I think that the one thing is that, I mean, it seems like they are kind of like a little bit stalemated. That's one thing I'll say in between like the rebels and the government forces. You know, there's a retreat and there's an attack. There's a retreat.
Well, and fundamentally, this is one of the concerns here. If our entire mission is nothing but make sure the people in the rebel cities don't get slaughtered. Well, what does that mean? Well, that means putting a wall around right them now, and defending them for the next 4 years.
Yeah.
You know.
Well, I don't know, but there's been some signals from, you know, you've had two top leaders of the Libyan government leave. Some people, I think I just saw a news flash that some other government official is trying to offer some kind of a truce.
Yep.
Okay. You know, so there's a lot of swirling rumors.
Well, there's certainly the possibility that within the 60 days I talked about before, you know, the Gaddafi government really does fall apart and he leaves and, you know, the quote unquote rebels take over and everybody's happy and we all go home. Now, of course, who knows, you know, the rebels aren't exactly a unified group amongst themselves. It wouldn't be surprising if you got all kinds of internal fighting once Gaddafi was gone. It's by no means clear exactly who would take over and how that would work. But, oh, and I should mention, the one thing I forgot to mention in all this, it came out this week, leaked, that several weeks before the UN resolution, Obama had authorized covert actions within Libya. So yes, CIA folks in Libya gathering intelligence, certain kinds of covert support to the rebels, other stuff like that. It's secret, so it's not clear exactly what's going on. But Obama had authorized our covert involvement and basically told the CIA to get in and do what they can do. What that means, who knows, but, which is also an interesting development, was mentioned a couple places, no boots on the ground doesn't necessarily mean no shoes on the ground. Anyway.
Right.
Final thing to mention before I move on, the article that I was mentioning about, somebody suggesting why, Obama couldn't have just made the speech about the turd sandwich, was on Wonkette.com on March 30th by Jack Stoof. I don't know if that's really how you pronounce it. S-T-U-E-F. It's either stuff or stoof or... Anyway, the title of it was Why Didn't Obama Just Tell Us He Thinks Libya Is a Turd Sandwich? Okay, let's take a break. We'll be back. We'll talk about the really exciting...
I guess I will just say one thing. It's the same reason why it was kind of like unprecedented for... What's his name? Who was that Howard Dean to go like crazy on stage?
Yes.
That's why.
I know that's why. But he didn't have to use the words turd sandwich. But I think he could have gone in and say, look, I'll be honest with you guys. This is an unpalatable situation. None of the options are really good. But there's a... There's a dynamic situation on the ground. People are going to be slaughtered if we don't intervene. We have the capability of intervening. We have a moral obligation to help. And boom, go in. Now, again, it puts you up against the questions of, well, how about all the other places where something's going on? You know, and there are dozens of places across the world where bad things are happening to people. And I think the key comes in. We have the capabilities easily lined up. It is aligned with some of our interests. We're interested in the stability of that region. If something dynamic was going on, to use your previous example, inside Russia, you know, we're not going to do anything there. We're not going to go into Tibet. We're not going to do any of these kinds of things. This is an area where all the stars aligned. We had international support. We had the troops that we needed already within range. I shouldn't say troops, the planes we needed already within range, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. And so that's why this and not something else. But I think it could have been framed in a way that, was better. I think
it would better. Anyway,
his main problem these last few weeks has been figuring out the right way to communicate this stuff, whereas it seemed like his tendency is to just do the shit and not even worry about like communicating why he's doing it, getting people on his side, getting the support lined up. He doesn't seem to give a crap. He's just like going in and doing what he thinks is right, which, okay, but, you know, he's not a king. He's a president, and you know, part of his job is, you know, bringing the public along, not just going out and doing whatever the fuck he wants. Now, however, I fully admit, you know, part of the job is also, if you feel you know the right thing to do and the public is against you, you do it anyway. But anyway, let's move on. We'll take a break. It's time for your poem of the week. We'll be back after the poem. Enjoy.
This is the Curmudgeon's Corner Poem of the Week, brought to you by No Tell Motel.
Box 6, Portrait, by Boyer Rickle. Watermark, a backlit page. Flat life? Like breath, a condition. Flat death? Of the paper. Death, he said, took his friend's faces. An eraser wears a hole. He painted himself, through the paper. Nests so soft they're worn as socks. What face through the words? A photo someone took. Backlit, a condition. Breath, watermarks, soft death, a face. Mark my words, someone says, to assert himself.
For more like this, go to notelmotel.org, with a new poet each week and a new poem every weekday.
Okay, so we're back, and the next topic on the list is our exciting field of Republican presidential candidates for 2012. There was a notice...
Or not.
I mean, okay. just to give you an idea, there was a notice put out. The first Republican candidate presidential debate was originally scheduled
in May.
For the first week of May. The people putting on that debate, and I forget which news network it was, NBC, Fox, I don't know, one of them, has said that they have canceled that debate because there are not enough candidates officially in the race at this point.
I am shocked by the lack of officially announced candidates for this next election by the Republicans. I mean, I would have thought they were so emboldened after the last election that I would have thought that they would have been all just falling all over themselves to challenge Obama. What do you think? Why do you think that nobody's taken the
punch? I think they're a combination of things. All of the big name Republicans with the exception of Romney, that everybody expects will run. You've got a number of factors. One, despite everything and what happened with the congressional elections, Obama is in a pretty strong position here. Unless the economy goes south and goes south fast, which doesn't appear likely, he's in a good position in terms of, even, and we've talked about this on the show before, even with the Republican Congress, in many ways, having a Republican Congress actually strengthens Obama's position coming into the next election. That's one part of it. The other part of it is, the radical Republican teabagger wing, whatever, I think is running the risk of, just having the Republican primaries be a bloodbath against anybody who's even remotely moderate.
Yes.
And so
that's true.
So like anybody who's sort of, mainstream traditional Republican type,
he's going to get killed.
Know that first of all, they would have to go way to the right in order to, stay, competitive. They know that all of these vocal people are coming in and, expecting them to be all, all Tea Party-ish or birthers or whatever, if they're not willing to do all that, then they're like, screw this, something has to happen here. The Republican Party is going to go crazy and nominate like a Palin or a Bachman or somebody like that and go down to utter defeat. And then we'll come in 2016. So I think you've got a lot of your major, potentially like, mainstream candidates are gun shy because of that, because they feel like this is not a year for a mainstream candidate. And even if a mainstream candidate won, it would be a very hard battle against Obama that is likely to be a loss. So in many ways, this is similar to the Democrats in 1992. Everybody thought at the time that it was time to jump into the race, everybody thought that George H.W. Bush was invincible. He was coming off the victory in Gulf War I. He had incredibly high approval ratings. And so all of your major, potentially major candidates decided not to run. And so then you had...
the economy went into the shithole.
And then the economy, you know, went south. But then by that time, it was too late for a lot of these big candidates. You had the Democrats. You know, lots of our listeners may not remember this. But, you know, we had... they were being called Snow White and the Seven Dwarfs.
Right.
Because we had... what was her name? The candidate from... She was Colorado, right? Anyway, there was one woman candidate and then seven male candidates, none of which are were very well known.
Cuomo, there was all the Cuomo rumors whether he would run or not.
And he's
run,
one of the major candidates who decided not to run, was Mario Cuomo.
Right.
And then one of those seven dwarfs was, of course, Bill Clinton, who was a nobody at the time, but took advantage of this vacuum. And you know, managed to win, and you know, and then George Bush ended up being a lot more vulnerable than anybody thought, and surprise, President Bill Clinton, you know,
yep,
and you know, we do have that same kind of scenario here. Now I hope we don't end up with a President Sarah Palin because of it, but you know, but right now I think you've got an incredibly weak Republican field out there. I mean, I just saw a note the other day that, you know, this early polls are very unreliable. You can't really tell anything by polls. So a lot of people look at the fundraising numbers instead. And right now, from right. an exploratory point of view, Michelle Bachmann has raised more money than Romney. You know?
Ouch.
Yeah. And, yeah, for those who don't Ouch. Know Michelle Bachmann, she's one of your Tea Party wacko jobs. You know, and...
Is she the one from Delaware?
I think so.
Yeah. She's that lunatic. Okay, the one that got killed in the primaries. Okay, yeah. Jesus Christ. She's... Mike, oh...
No, she's
fuck, mate.
Wait, no, Minnesota. She's an actual congressman from Minnesota.
Oh, she's a congressman from Minnesota.
Yeah. Anyway, but you know, so we've got things like, you know, you've got Newt Gingrich, who every 4 years since he was speaker has talked about potentially running for president. Apparently, more serious than ever. Blah blah blah. He might actually run. But if he does run, he's got extremely bad negatives.
Blah, 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 blah. Baloney. He's never freaking running.
We've apparently got Michelle Bachmann. You know, she's the founder of the House Tea Party Caucus. We've got Romney, who, of course, you know, essentially was... He wasn't actually the runner up in terms of delegates. That was Huckabee, but he was a very strong contender last time around on the Republican side, and so he's a natural. Like the Republicans, generally, like the thought process is, you know, Democrats have all out battles. Republicans end up nominating whoever's next in line, and Romney right. would be next in line, according to that kind right. of thing.
Right.
But, you know, he's got the problem that he's a Mormon, and a lot of the sort of right wing religious conservative types in the Republican Party,
they're going to vote for him.
Like that, you know. And then we've got like of course, we've got Ron Paul thinking about it. We've got Rand Paul thinking about it as well. And I actually think Rand Paul would be more interesting than Ron Paul at this point, but apparently his take at this point is he will run if his father doesn't. And his father is thinking about running again. So we'll see. I think at this point, like, you know, I liked Ron Paul for a lot of things. He messed up quite a bit in the last campaign. And at this point, frankly, he's too old. Come on.
I see. I will say this: you said about President Palin. I mean, you know, let's face it. If you look at the numbers, she's got the worst numbers of any of the Republicans.
Although, frankly, some of these other people are coming close, though. I mean, they don't have anybody. Like, and this is the thing. I've seen a couple of things on like 538.com and such, where they've done some of these polls on, you know, do you have a positive or negative view of this candidate? Blah blah blah, and not a single person on the Republican list has, you know, higher favorable ratings than unfavorable ratings.
Right, I'm looking at these. For example, it's Romney 21%, 21%.
Give where you're
20%.
Looking.
20%. Palin 13%.
Where are you looking?
Kinrich 11%. It's this Pew Research poll, March 8th.
Okay.
Basically, just on what the were they favorable, unfavorable. So look at these numbers. I mean, you look at okay. So national number, favorable, unfavorable. Obama. Favorable 58%, unfavorable 39%. Okay, now, for president, Republican primary amongst Republicans, these are the numbers.
Amongst
Romney,
Republicans.
Romney 21%. Right. Romney 21%, Huckabee 20%, Palin 13%, Gingrich 11%, Paul 8%, Pawlenty 3%, Daniels 2%, Santorum, our buddy, 2%, Barber 2%, Christie 2%. I mean, it's like, looking ahead, would you like to see Barack Obama reelected president in 2012, or you prefer a Republican candidate win the election? 48% Obama, 35% Republican. And so he's winning 30%.
Wait, that one's not among Republicans, right?
No, that's just okay. Overall. That's just across the – but listen to the numbers. By party ID, what made up that 48%? 33% Democrat, 24% Republican, 38% Independent.
Yep.
So you look at those numbers, and you got to be thinking about jumping into this election. You're like, shit.
Well, I mean, it all looks bad overall.
Just looking at the wrong numbers. I know that there's a long time to there. I know there's a lot of things changed, et cetera, and so forth and whatever. But obviously, the numbers, if you're a candidate and you're trying to raise funds and you look at Romney struggling to raise funds against Michelle Bachmann, you see this shit. I mean, how are you getting so enticed into trying to do this?
Right. I think they're all going to sit out. All of the sort of reasonable Republicans. Here's the problem with the Republicans right now. They are actively squeezing out the quote-unquote reasonable Republicans. You know?
Right.
And you know, I think the presidential election is going to show that. And what's going to happen, apparently – well, we'll see what happens. But one possibility here is that the Republicans do, in fact, nominate, someone that really is on the extremes of their party, and they go down in utter flames. And then the
Michael Steele.
And then the party actually starts to try to figure out how to recover itself in the next 4 years, and say, that really didn't work. Yeah, or they just go ahead and freaking split up, Of course, that's not going to get any of them elected, but,
not particularly, no.
At some point we have to have a realignment again. What happens, often cases like, the American system is structured to be a two-party system. It makes it very, very hard the way that things are laid out and structured to have anything else. But every once in a while, one of those parties sort of diminishes, and then effectively what happens is the other one splits in half. But I don't know that we're there yet, but the Republicans have to do something to turn this around. Because the other thing is just pure demographic factors. They have been positioning themselves more and more as sort of the party of, traditional white Christian Southern, they want to be, the Leave It to Beaver family. And that's what they're advocating. And just demographically, the country is moving away from that. Ethnically, we're becoming more diverse. The types of families are becoming more diverse. Everything is moving away from that sort of pure model from the social side. And so as long as they continue to appeal more and more to that sort of core group, they may get higher support from from that sort of group, but they're going to be outnumbered. They are outnumbered, and that trend's going to continue. For that party to continue to be viable, they have to figure out how to appeal, to large numbers of you know, of blacks, Hispanics, you know, non-Christian, you know, they have to be able to appeal to gay people, for God's sake, you know.
Yeah.
And, you know, the Republicans aren't very good at that right now. You know,
not particularly.
Yes, there are the log cabin Republicans, but they're kind of been beat up themselves. You know.
Yes. All right. Well, listen, I think, you know, in the interest of time, let's you know, we talked about the candidates. Let's go. Let's take a break. And what's our next topic on the pipeline right now?
Cable companies versus content companies. So, all right, we'll be back after this talking about that.
Ready for the test, Dracula?
I'm ready, Frankenstein. Then let us begin.
Creepy Classic celebrates the classic horror and science fiction films from the silent era through the 1960s, and retro TV horror from the 1950s to the 1970s. Visit creepyclassics.com for all your classic video needs. And when you buy something, tell Ron that the curmudgeons say hello.
Okay, and so I'll point out right now that if we finish up in the next 2 minutes, we can finish the show in less than an hour.
Okay. All right. Okay. So the cable companies are done. They did a pad and a thing. And they're broadcasting it. Okay. Well, you know. Okay. So they don't like it. Okay.
No, sorry, guys. We're gonna go slightly over an hour. Look.
Okay.
So here's the thing. I guess the basics of this. A couple of different cable companies put out iPad apps that let you, if you were a subscriber to their cable company, you can stream the cable content you're already paying for over their app, right? I mean, I don't think it's all their channels, but they selected some channels. It's live. It's not like, you know, and so several of the cable channels themselves were like, no, you can't do this. No, turn us off. And so, you know, they ended up turning off those channels, and I believe they added some other channels in their place. And once again, my thought process here is the content companies have absolutely no clue how to deal with this stuff. I mean, fundamentally,
I don't know.
This ties into what the New York Times was doing the other week too, which is now in effect, by the way. But they want to be able to charge you to view the show on the TV, charge you again for your computer, charge you again for your iPad, charge you again for your iPhone, charge you again if you want to view it live versus later on down the road. They want you then to go and buy the DVD, you know. No. You know?
Well, look, last year, DirecTV launched NFL Sunday Ticket on your mobile device. Okay?
Yeah.
So you could watch the live football games on a mobile device. They did charge extra. I can't remember the amount. I think it was like $35. The standard subscription is $200. Okay? $200 to $300. I can't remember exactly. That's $300 for the high definition for the whole year. They would charge you to enable your internet access. They would charge you an extra $30. I think it was something like that. Okay, I did pay the $30. Okay, because honestly, it was only an extra 10%. So therefore, it wasn't the wacko rate in order to get it on there. And I must admit that having the content available mobile was quite convenient for that. And the fact that you couldn't really get that content anywhere else made it that I'm like, this is a live game, okay? You know, it's like, shit, I want to watch. I want to watch it when it's happening, okay? So I did do that. However, most content is not that compelling. Why the hell am I going to pay extra
to go and like watch at the moment something is some stupid the Housewives of fucking Miami are being broadcast at 10 a.m. Why would I care if I'm watching it later recorded? Who the fuck cares? And that's why I'm like seeing like companies are now making the difference between, say, compelling content or who the fuck really cares? I mean, I'm like, you're not going to really convince people to pay extra to be able to watch fucking, you know, that kind of crap, like on some other device.
I mean, look, one of the things is, you know, we're evolving towards a world where a screen is a screen is a screen is a screen. And if somebody has right. access in one place, they expect to have access in all places.
Everywhere.
And they don't expect right. to have to nickel and dime play separately for every screen. I'm sorry. You know, and if you try to do that, people are going to figure out ways around you. You know, look, you know, my personal solution, you know, right now I have a Sling box attached to a TiVo. I love it. Almost all of my television watching is not in front of the actual place where the device is attached to the projector in our family room. You know,
my Sling box is dead, so I don't know.
I watch on my laptop all the time. I sometimes watch on my iPhone. If I had an iPad, I'd certainly be watching on that thing. you know, and I get access to my full cable subscription. Now, having said that, that still relies on the cable company. And frankly, I don't think that's going to be the case, you know, in another 5-10 years. You know, everything's going to be internet first, you know, and the cable companies own the bandwidth. They should be happy about that. Just change the damn fucking model. But nobody's going to buy your channel packages after a while. They're going to go and get the shows directly off the internet that they want when they want it.
I will disagree a little bit. I'm looking at, you know, if you get a bundle that is at a decent price, I mean, you'll probably purchase a package of entertainment versus, you know, buying individual.
Yeah, yeah. It all depends on the pricing. Absolutely correct. Like,
right.
You know,
right.
I get probably a couple hundred channels. I probably watch 10 of them. But if those 10 channels were $15 a month each, it would be more than my package, you know?
That's right. That's right.
You know, so it does all depend on the pricing and how that works and blah, blah, blah. But I think the pressures are also there driving pricing down, you know, and they're right. resisting it, kicking and screaming. But in the end, the price pressure is downward. And you've got...
But is it really that downward? I mean, seriously, think about it. You're paying for a package, say, of 200 channels, and you're paying $100 a month. I mean, seriously, you're paying what? I mean, you're paying 50 cents per channel a month?
Right, no, but look... I mean, really,
when you break it out?
But again,
I mean, yes, there are some channels that obviously are more expensive. Like ESPN is able to charge a significant premium. You know, they probably get maybe like 8 to 10% of that dollar. That's right, yes.
But
you know...
Look, here's the thing. Again, you have to look at it based on what people actually watch, not what they do. But look,
right.
here's the competing model. There's like Netflix. You know, flat fee per month, much lower than your cable companies.
If
you're willing to watch shows a little bit after they're new instead of the moment they come out, same with movies, you know, you could get 100% of your TV watching from Netflix right now. And Netflix, within the last couple of weeks, announced they're also now starting to produce some original content. Now, of course, there's a backlash to that. Some of the content companies are pulling out of Netflix and saying you can't have your content on there.
Right,
but that's the kind of battle you're going to have here.
But that's a pricing battle, not so much a delivery battle. That is a battle about how much, when they did the contract with Netflix.
It's not only that. Yes, it is a pricing battle, and it is that, but it's also direct control. Like, all of the content providers would much rather have you going to their own sites to grab their stuff under their own terms and conditions rather than going through any sort of aggregator site like Netflix. You know,
that's just insane. I mean, that is going to drive, I mean, that is such so balkanized and causes so many problems. I mean, I'm like, I don't want to have to shop through 30 different providers for entertainment or 50 or 70.
I don't want to have to know. Like when I hear about a show,
freaking applications on my fucking iPad to watch different content.
Yeah, no, when I hear about a show that I want to watch, the name should be all I need to know. I should go to the place where I get shows and get that show. You know, I shouldn't have to think, is this an HBO show or is this an NBC show or is it owned by this or is it owned by that? Is it available on Hulu? Right. Is it available on Netflix? I shouldn't have to care about any of that crap. I should just go and, you know, type in what I want and boom, I have it. And, you know, one of the advantages of the TiVo thing is, you know, right now its interface does that. It's got your cable, it's got your Netflix, it's got like several others, and it's a unified search. But even that's not really doing the trick, you know. This is rapidly evolving, and the frustrating part of this always, and we're not even talking about sort of DRM and privacy and piracy this time around, but the frustrating part is even when you're talking about all the legal alternatives, you see the content companies getting dragged, kicking and screaming into it and fighting every piece of innovation that comes around the pike, you know, people are going to want to watch on their iPads. Duh, they're not going to want to pay you nickel and dime for every little thing they watch either. You know, figure out the way to get in there and jump in with 2 feet. Don't fight everything. We can't come back to this enough times. In the end, yes, they might make less money than they used to. Sorry. You know, the title of our show a couple of weeks ago was The World Changes, Get Over It, or something like that.
Yes.
You know, and that's what's going on here is, I mean, you've got a lot of people, you know, fighting, kicking and screaming to keep alive old ways of doing things that are now obsolete due to the technology. You know, I saw some people trying to explain the New York Times pricing model, saying the only way this makes sense, this pricing model, is if you're not actually trying to get people to sign up online to view the Times online. It's if you're trying to get them to sign up for the damn paper version of the paper with the online stuff as a bonus. And I'm sorry, 5-10 years from now, the number of people who were going to want that physical piece of paper in their hands is going to be trivially small and shrinking daily as those people die.
However, I will tell you this, though. Yesterday,
I did.
Yesterday, I went to the beach, and I didn't want to carry an iPad or any of that stuff. And so I bought the paper. I got to tell you something.
There's something about the paper. It is what? Yes. It's better?
It is better to read. It may not be as convenient to get, okay? But it is better to read. We were just having this discussion with my wife yesterday, who reads a lot of books. And one of the reasons she bought an iPad was to buy a book. And yesterday, she actually picked up a book. I was reading a physical book. And we're having a discussion that, honestly, it still is a lot easier on the eyes and to read it on a physical book.
That's what the e-paper solutions are for. Like, you don't have that problem with
It's not even non-LCD. Just that. It's just the actual shape of it. It's on paper.
I agree. There is still a density you can achieve with paper. I wouldn't say so much for books. For books, I think, like, if you've got e-paper instead of LCD, you've got a pretty good solution. And if you want a bigger screen, with newspapers and magazines, I can still buy it. Yeah. What?
You get a newspaper. A newspaper is still, you open it, it is enormously far bigger than any screen that you really practically will have.
But do you actually,
but there is a reason why I realized I like that. It's because when you're leafing through the paper itself,
there
is a lot of articles that you will pay attention that you definitely that never would have paid attention if it was online.
I agree. I can see that. I know
it's dying. I know the reasons. I understand why. But I will still tell you that after yesterday's spending, you know, normally, I would have gone to the New York Times website or whatever. I would have spent 10, 15 minutes yesterday. You know what? I grabbed a copy of Barron's and I grabbed a copy of New York Times. You know how long I spent reading them? 2 hours.
Right. Yeah, okay. Well, that's part of the dying stuff, too. Hardly anybody, except when you're, like, going to the beach for the day or something, hardly anybody has 2 hours to spend on anything. But, like, I will admit that I was
at Miami Beach yesterday, and I was just sitting down, like, calmly, you know, at a nice place and just being able to relax and just spend the afternoon doing that. Yes,
yeah,
I did.
I can see that. Now, to me, like, I was going to say, like, I always... I certainly understand the information density. On a full-size newspaper, you get a lot more on that page, and you can, if you're just scanning, you can scan through a lot more in a lot shorter time. That is certainly absolutely true. But it's been many years since I've bought a physical paper, but my constant memory of physical papers was how much of a fucking... Oh, sorry, my language. How much of a pain in the ass... Oops. Sorry. How much of a pain?
Well, a pain in the ass is not that bad.
Well, you know. Anyway. The huge piece of paper that, like, I had to figure out how to fold and move around, and if there was any wind, it would be, like, all bleh. And, like, if I'm trying to, like, you know, I remember trying to read a paper on a bus or whatever, and there are people next to you, and you're trying to avoid hitting them, and, you know, oh, it's such a pain. And I'll be honest, like, when I think of something like, you know, the New York Times, you're right. If you're just leisurely, I'm going to go through the paper and see what's interesting, okay, maybe it is a better form factor, you know, and you know, they're probably going to be equivalents to that once they've got flexible screens and stuff you can pull out, and there'll be technological solutions to that too. But frankly, my most common use of things from that kind of thing is, you know, I might read a handful of articles that are either the headlines of the day or on specific topics I care about. And, you know, frankly, I've moved on, you know, a very, very tiny portion of my reading is stuff that comes from newspapers and magazines anyway. Now, it might be commentary on stuff that's in newspapers and magazines by people who I like reading, but I only essentially go to the original articles when somebody I follow talks about it and says, hey, this is a really good article, you should read it. Otherwise, you know, I'm just not there.
I hear you. I understand. But I was not talking so much about the content itself, but I just... there are certain advantages to the form factor that you don't get. But I understand that they are, for the most part, overcome by the immediacy, timeliness, ease of access, et cetera, and so forth. Yeah, I know.
Yeah.
But, you know.
So, anyway. You know, bottom line, you know, The content stuff, whether it be print content or video content or music content, you know, all of these content originators are just fighting to keep these old methods of distribution and delivery alive. And they are swimming against the tide. And, you know, if they continue to swim against the tide, the only thing that will guarantee will be at the end of this battle, they will not be the ones that are left. Somebody else who's willing to actually be innovative in these areas is going to take up the mantle, and that's going to be where people get their content from. You know, it's just, you can't move on to succeeding in the new world by clinging on to the old world. The people who succeed are the ones who completely embrace the new way of doing things. So that's it. And I think that's our show. Without breaks, we're already over an hour and 10 minutes. Sorry, guys. With breaks, we're going to be longer. And just guess. I don't know what the poem of the week is yet, but by our luck, it's going to be a really, really long poem that takes me 10 minutes to read. Anyway, that's it for our show. Thanks, everybody, for listening. As usual, tell your friends and email me with any questions, comments, thoughts at abelsmay@abelsmay.com. We do love it when we get comments. We can't always take a whole segment on them like we did today, but thank you, everybody. And with that, tune in next week. Goodbye.
Bye-bye.
Later.